What is up, everyone? Welcome back to the Blade Dive. I'm your host, Parker Bohan, and I'm so stoked you're tuned in. If you haven't already, make sure you're subscribing to the channel. It would mean a lot to me. And be sure to follow us on social media at The Blade Dive on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Tag us in those photos. Okay, my guest today is Frank Wells. And Frank is somebody that's been associated with halfpipe construction for quite some time now, but that's only because his love and passion for the sport led him to that. He was a pro rider before he was a pro builder. I'll put it that way. Frank has such a passion for building a quality product, but he also has a passion for building upon the relationships that he's established within the industry. There are tons of stories in this episode, and I can't wait for you to hear them. We hit and discuss what it was like growing up in Wilmington, North Carolina, chasing the surf. We talk about Snowpark New Zealand and just the animal that that thing was, being able to produce it and then seeing the final product and the media that came out of there. We definitely hit the future and kind of where things are with equipment, but we also talk about the elephant in the room, which is just there aren't that many half pipes around anymore. So if you're at home right now, grab a drink, kick your feet up, and if you're in the machine, you know what to do. Turn up the volume. What is up, everybody? Welcome to the Blade Dive. And today's guest, man, it's heavy in the room today with experience, and it's not from my end, that's for sure. Frank Wells is with me in the virtual booth today, and he is no stranger to making an impact in the terrain park and ski resort operations world, but he's also been known to kick skateboard around and love surfing. So I can't wait to get into it. Frank, how are you? Thanks for being here.
Good. Thanks for having me on, Parker.
Yeah, it's really an honor. You know, it's quite humbling when you get to catch up with people that you have admired from afar. And so I just thanks for your time, man, and being on the show. I think Bunnell did a pretty good job of summing up kind of some experiences you two had together. And I think right out of the gate, I want to know one of the stories. Mike mentioned something about building, literally building one of the X Games pipes at Aspen with the trash cats. Is that correct? I believe Mike, but I want to know your story.
Oh yeah. And it wasn't just 1 year. There were 2 or 3 years that I think we were using those cats. The incident that Mike refers to is definitely a classic. It's you know, looking back on it now, it's easy to kind of, you go, oh, okay, I kind of see what happened. But so we had these, they were 275s. There was a couple of them with a lot of hours on them, but these big cages, not like the nice ones that Vail and Aspen Snowmass and everybody uses. These were, you know, kind of junkers that just rattled all over the place. And when you were going, you were making a lot of noise. And, you know, this is back before we were organizing with snowmaking, where you'd go make them a nice little pad and they'd make snow here and we'd push it there. It was just, you know, thrown out there, like wherever the hydrants were, that's where the fan guns went. They were just buried. So I kept having the tracks skip, you know, from the wet snow, but unbeknownst to me at the time that was the cause. So we kept having the tracks tighten because it's just rattling this thing all around. And so they kept tightening them. And sure enough, I want to say it was probably our third or fourth day there, just pushing in wet snow, making snow, and just pushed right through all five of the drive belts. Bam, 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 bam. And just like Mike said, we had to go down there, tail between our legs, apologize, and, you know, help them fix it. And they got us going. The mechanics at Buttermilk, I mean, Donnie and his crew, that's, you know, I don't know, you and Mike touched on that. They are the true unsung heroes of the ski areas. But they really did save the day, man. They got that thing going, you know, in a day, half a day or something, and we were back at it. But, yeah. Quite the experience. I probably had, I forget what year that was, but
how many hours in a cat?
I don't think I'd been in it. I probably had, you know, 1400 hours in a cat, you know, sitting in the passenger seat. But at that point, I don't know. Probably my second season pushing snow in a cat, you know, myself. So yeah, definitely some operator error involved in that one.
Yeah, but I mean, unbeknownst to you, like you just said, you know, it's like, hey, I think this might be the problem. We just need to crank her down a little bit.
And to be completely honest, I didn't come up with the idea that the tracks needed to be tightened. You know, I'm just like sitting there like, what do you do? Like, it keeps popping and they're like, oh, we can tighten the tracks. I'm like, oh, okay. So again, operator error. like it usually is.
Yeah, no, it happens for sure. It happens. But that was just a trip to me, because I know there's been times where I put myself in a situation where you're using whatever you can get your hands on to get the job done. But when you're building something like that at a competition venue with whatever you can get your hands on, that's just, I think, a testament to your story. Straight up.
Yeah.
Just throwing that out there right out for everybody to understand. Frank Wells is 100% on board with using the trash cat if he has to.
Like Mike said, the only, you know, if a cat ran, and I still say that, you know, that's the best cat you can use is one that's running.
Yeah, get it. Make sure it gets back to the shop. And if it's running, yeah, use that one for sure. I don't want to go too chronologically, but I'm excited you're on the show, and I definitely want to get into maybe a little bit more of who you are and what it was like growing up. We were catching up and you mentioned, I had no idea. And so maybe just elaborate on that and let us know what growing up as Frank Wells looked like.
Yeah. You know, so I'm from, Wilmington, North Carolina. So southeastern North Carolina. I grew up, surfing and skating kind of in that area, you know, in the mid to late 80s. You know, I think by age 10 or 11, I was pretty hardcore into skateboarding almost every day. And then once I got kind of old enough to start getting to the beach on my own, I really got into surfing. So that's where my passion was for all those years. You know, I'd seen snowboarding, and I think, you know, one of our friends had gone out west that was a skier and, you know, came back one time with a VHS of The Blizzard of Oz or one of those Greg Stump movies. And we all just sat around at the beach kind of like, well, that looks crazy, man. They're just, you know, jumping off cliffs and stuff. But it didn't really relate to us kind of the way the, you know, it sounds like the Southern California culture was all, you know, kind of encompassed there. You could surf, skate, snow, where you could do it all in the same day. And so, yeah, it was just, that was kind of what we did. It was, you know, anytime there was a hurricane, obviously that was brought the excitement level up for the surfing, because North Carolina is not exactly, it gets good surf, but it's just not very consistent. Long flat spells there on the East Coast.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe dive into that, pun intended, with the board and just kind of, so developing an interest for surfing. You're on the coast, but you don't necessarily have the West Coast waves. Were you traveling at all to accomplish kind of the dream of catching the barrel elsewhere other than Wilmington?
Yeah, you know, we would kind of, as the hurricanes move up and down the East Coast, it's, you know, the kind of the shape of the coast, you can really kind of start to predict the winds and what it's going to do. And that really is where I started kind of becoming a weather geek, as far as just, you know, being able to understand where the front's going to be, you know, that combined with the tides, just like every surfer gets, you know, really good at that at their home spots. And we, you know, we'd go up to New Jersey, we'd go to Rhode Island, we'd go down to Florida. So, you know, as soon as I was old enough to drive, you know, if there was a hurricane, we were chasing it.
Yeah, right on. I have to ask too, like, introduction to stuff like that, skateboarding, surfing, all the stuff you were trying to tackle and get, or become a part of on the East Coast. How was that introduced to you? Was that just kind of like the friends, the homies, the neighborhood?
You know, I think it was just the neighborhood friend, you know, neighborhood kids. Everybody was skateboarding. You know, we rode our bikes around like everybody else. And, you know, the skateboarding came along. A lot of it was the age of, you know, I'm old, but I'm not old enough to have been enjoying all those parks they built in the 70s. I wasn't into it then. Yeah. So, you know, we were kind of in that backyard ramp era. Mm. Street skating was just starting to take off a little bit, but it was really about, you know, backyard half pipes. And so there was a couple in our neighborhood and everybody would just kind of pal around and, you know, go skate for the day.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I remember skating across Wilmington, you know, we'd skate 6 miles to, you know, skate some stupid curb right in front of a 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
And, you know, we thought that was the greatest thing ever. So, you know, it was kind of that travel bug, I guess, if you will, started that young for me of with surfing and skating, knowing that you kind of got to move around to get it the best.
Yep. Yeah, that's so true. You got to move around to be able to get what you want out of the experience and become better at the craft. I tried surfing once and I absolutely sucked at it. So huge shout out to Greg Hahn. Greg, if you're listening, thanks for putting up with me eating lots of shit in the sandbar down there. Yeah, that was fun. It's hard, man. Like, I don't know how else to really put it. You got to put in your time. So I need to put in the time. But at any rate, what are your thoughts on?
Yeah,
definitely put in the time. Where were you traveling the furthest?
We go just like Rhode Island.
Cool.
What's it? I think it's called Rug. Is it Rug? I might be mispronouncing Ruggles or something like that. It was a really good point break. you had to go through these like massive mansions, like kind of, you know, duck through their fences and whatnot to get to a really cool, there's some amazing coastline up there. And it just takes just the right angle to kind of get up in there from the storms coming. You know, the hurricanes all like to come up that kind of that alley there, and they tend to hit North Carolina and South Carolina. But when they don't, that's when it's the best for us. You get, you know, the wind switch and you got the offshore wind, and the hurricane's only 500-600 miles off the coast. So, you know, the swell is really, really short duration. So we enjoyed it.
Do you think you let your parents in, or do you remember letting your parents in on every surfing adventure you had? Was it kind of a, hey, we're going surfing, I don't know when we'll be back? Or was it, hey, so we're going to Rhode Island, we'll be back here, here's the map, here's where we'll be?
A little bit of both. Kind of, you know, some of the travels, that Rhode Island trip was just before I moved out west. So at that point, I had moved out. You know, as a kid, you know, we were lucky to get up and down from, you know, one side to the other. North Carolina's got some real distinctive capes. There's three capes there. The one we lived on was Cape Fear. So you got one beach that faces due south, just about, and you got one beach that that faces due east. And so it's, you know, got almost a perfect 90. So the art, again, is just figuring out with the tide and the wind and the swell where it's coming together. And, you know, that was, you know, if surfing was more consistent, especially in that area, I probably never would have found snowboarding. It's a beautiful spot. It's gotten really crowded like everywhere else that's good in the world. But it was a great place to grow up.
Yeah, that's awesome. It sounds like it. When was your first surfboard purchase, or how did you get your first surfboard? Did you buy it? Did you win it in a contest?
The first one I got, I bought it. I'm trying to think of Dave's last name. He had this shop called The Cove in Carolina Beach. And I was working just like at an ice cream shop or something there on the boardwalk. And I had saved enough money to go buy a board. I'd been borrowing boards. There was a family, the Donaldsons, and they had three sons that were all really good surfers. And so I'd always be staying at their place down at the beach. And so I finally saved enough money and went and bought a board.
That's awesome. Yeah. I feel like there's that experience for skateboarding, snowboarding, surfing, whatever board sport you're in. If you're making it or building it, or you're buying it, or you got it for free, whatever that experience is initially, that I just don't think you ever really forget that. You take that with you and you hold on to that for life, just because that's your introduction into your own commitment, your own piece that you now own, that you're a part of.
The Grom froth is real, you know.
Yeah, it is.
When you're frothing, it's just every day you can't wait to get there. I feel real lucky that started in skating and surfing.
I remember that experience. It was a cool one, and being proud of it and going, this is mine. I got to take care of it. It was a snowboard, but, and we touched on the skating thing for a little bit, but you were a shop sponsored skater too, right?
Yeah. So, you know, back then it was, we had some little local contests that we would do, and one of the skate shops had a ramp. So I kind of skated for them. And, I really, towards the end, I mean, I still love skateboarding. I skated, you know, pretty heavily through the whole time that I was snowboarding for a living, and never on the level of anybody. I joke around like Richards is Todd's a skateboarder.
I was
just playing around with it, you know. But I loved it, and it kind of the surfing and the skating really is what made it easier for me to transition into snowboarding, you know.
Absolutely. Did you ever, back in the day, you got a kickflip today, Frank? You got a kickflip?
Oh, no. I would not attempt a kickflip.
I totally destroyed my shin the other day trying to get one back, but I gave up on it. I was trying so hard there for a minute to just say, I'm going to do this by the time I'm 40. I'm taking a break. Yeah, I totally blasted my shin. And a 40 or a, so I'm 37, or I'll be 37 this year, this June. But 36-year-old shin doesn't recover quite as fast as a 16-year-old shin. So
wait a few more years.
Yeah, that's I guess scared maybe isn't the right word, but I'm definitely just kind of going, I'm getting old. I'm just gonna accept that. That's really cool. I think that you're right, like that transition to snowboarding would have been really smooth because of the surfing and the skating, having that underneath your feet already. What did that journey look like? Was that more of a hey, I've got an interest in going out west. I've got an interest in maybe exploring areas around the East Coast. I know we mentioned snowshoe when we were catching up. And did you kind of test the water out east before you kind of jumped into it out west?
Yeah, you know, what actually happened is I went, they had a small tour called the ASP East, just a really small, you know, like a mini tour basically for surfing. And it was down in Florida. And so I went down there. I stayed, Bruce Martin, guy started Skatopia, just like a legend in the skateboard world. He was working at a park down there called Stone Edge. And so I went down there, stayed behind the Harley shop for a couple weeks, was going to do the events. The events, honestly, I think both windows, they got canceled because it was flat. You know, just skateboarding, having a little too much fun, to be completely honest, at night. And I was like, well, this does not seem that sustainable. So went back home, went back to North Carolina, enrolled in a good old Cape Fear Community College. You know, got my books, got everything ready. I think I made it, officially I made it 6 days.
Oh, sweet. I mean, almost so, a full week if you count Sunday.
Well, I'm in the parking lot with all the same bad habits and same people from high school with the stuff we did there. And I'm like, so I'm paying to do this now. About the same time, you know, I had been living in Nag's Head, like we talked about on the Outer Banks, and everybody up there, everybody in the hospitality, you know, the bartenders, restaurants, everything where we worked, they all did, you know, half the year in Snowshoe, West Virginia, and the other half the year in Nag's Head. So a buddy called me and he goes, you know, hey, do you know how to ski? And I'm like, yeah, man, you know, I grew up skiing in North Carolina, you know, Cataloochee and Sapphire Valley.
Nice, Cataloochee.
Oh, yes. You know, and that was when I was, you know, 8, 9 years old or something. So he said, hey, got a job for you. Come on up. So my dad went to my dad at this point, not happy with me, to say the least.
Yeah.
not showing a lot of dedication to anything at this point. So he goes, you know what? You can have the deposit from your books. Okay. So I took the book. You know, books aren't cheap. So I don't know. It was $500, $600 or something.
Yeah.
And that was it. And that was the last, it was the best thing he ever did to me. And that was it. Cool. I was on my own. So up at Snowshoe, like I said, I, you know, classic ski business, getting into it. You know, I was bussing tables at night at a pasta joint and teaching little kids how to ski. That lasted, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks, but it was pretty funny because I'm seeing these guys snowboard and I'm getting to know them all. And I'm, you know, we're all kind of hanging out. And one afternoon, John Utz and Cookie Daniels, they're married now, you know, lifelong friends. They had Snowboarders in Exile. And so we sat there and drank beer and watched Snowboarders in Exile. And, you know, they had the Trans World snowboarding magazines with, you know, Breckenridge with the TDK Pro and all this. And I was instantly, I was like, I got to do this. I got to try it. So it took a little while. I borrowed a board, you know, borrowed some Sorels. I think, I don't know exactly how many days I got in that season, probably, you know, 20 or something. Went back to North Carolina, you know, season ended. It's a real short season there in Snowshoe. You know, go back to North Carolina, and I was just dead set on going west. So, you know, still surfing, still, you know, working at a restaurant at night. I did a little roofing during the day, you know, and saved my money. One of the funny things is that through the transition of, I kind of made it sound smooth, the transition of teaching kids to ski and not teaching kids to ski, there was a loss of a pass there on certain days. So,
oh, no kidding.
I swore at that point, I was like, I'm moving out west and nobody's going to have a pass over me. So I moved out west. First thing I did before I had a house was bought a Ski the Summit pass to guarantee I could ride every day. So it was pretty funny.
Were you goal focused or oriented towards how you were going to become that pro snowboarder, or was it just I'm all in, I'm betting on this, and I'm just going to practice? Or what did that look like?
You know, I think at that time it was goal oriented. It was just I was so obsessed with it.
Sure.
And to be honest, all the tricks that literally had evaded me, you know, frontside inverts, all these different things that I couldn't do on vert.
Yeah.
That on a snowboard, it's like, you know, three tries.
Yeah.
And you're doing it. You're like, man, the thing's strapped to your feet. This is insane.
Yeah.
And so I was so hooked. And Breckenridge in 91 and 92, it was, I mean, when I moved there that year, it was like Nate Cole, Roan Rogers, Dale Rayberg, Steve Blakely, Jay Nelson, all of us moved there that year. So, I mean, we're all at the skate park together. We're all snowboarding every day together. You know, it was a little bit of the heyday of snowboarding. I mean, I felt like everybody in that town was getting paid. You know, they were a sponsor. You know, you go to the Vegas trade show and, you know,
yeah,
all the people are from Bear, Summit, and Summit County.
Yeah.
The consistency, too, is what got me. Because, you know, surf, if you could surf every day, I mean, that's the surf bums, the original bump, you know, because you just, you're not going to work. All you need to do is get back in the water. And I think with snowboarding, when I, you know, my first year when I moved to Breckenridge, I rode 156 days straight.
Damn.
I did not stop. I was diehard. I worked at a restaurant called The Hearthstone, and it was just, you know, it was crack. I couldn't, it was every day. It was like, oh, we're going to Loveland Pass. Oh, we're, you know, we're going to go to Crested Butte. There's just, there's so much good, good riding in that area. And like I said, at the time, there was always a crew. There were so many different crews hanging out, and it was just awesome. So it was like, you know, it was pretty funny. At The Hearthstone, you know, I basically would come home and there was no time, you know, laundry. I'm a single, you know, single 20-year-old kid.
Yeah,
there's no time for any of that. So I'd take my uniform and I'd wash it with soap in the shower when I get home from work. Nice. I'd hang it up. We had a big, the outflow for the heat for the furnace. I'd hang it on there to dry all day. And I'd get compliments from this guy, Dick, that owned the Hearthstone. He'd be like, Frank, you look great today. By the end of the year, my uniform is so faded.
Oh my god!
You know, I'm putting like soap from the shower on. It was a sign of how committed I was to being able to snowboard every day and try to do as little else as possible.
Yeah, use the Old Spice to wash the uniform and then not worry about you know, buying the laundry detergent and paying for the quarters to put it in the machine. That's awesome.
Yeah,
so, resourceful. More power to you. Yeah. You can't knock it. You can't, you know, you can't hate the player. You can only hate the game. You were doing your thing. Yeah, that's right.
I was loving it.
That's rad.
So, I was loving it.
So you're out there and you're doing the snowboard scene and you're trying to get as many days, 150 plus. That's nuts. What does the entrance into that competition circuit look like for you?
One of the big, you know, we had the Rocky Mountain Snowboard Series. And so JJ Collier and Dave Collier, two guys from North Carolina, you know, I was riding with them all basically every day. So I'd travel with them and did a couple, you know, they're doing the pro division and I'd go do the AM and I won a couple of those. And then we had the Copper Mountain Series and, you know, that was fun competing against all kind of, you know, it was all kind of people, the Wattsells, it was great. I mean, it was just, like I said, it was a perfect time in snowboarding, hanging out. And then, the big event that we had around us was that, you know, they used to have the OP Pro. And so the OP Pro was at Copper. And it's funny, I'm good friends with him now, but Brian Harper was, you know, he's a big deal in snowboarding. He's a real big deal in skateboarding now with California Ramp Works. But, you know, I pull up and, you know, first year kind of sitting there and he's on the start of the pipe and he like lifts the fence up for me. He's like, get in here, man, make a run.
So rad.
And I was like, oh yeah. So
yeah, almost just as if to say barrier to entry lifted. Yeah, here you go.
It was cool. I've had it. And then, you know, fast forward later that summer and, you know, I'm up at Mount Hood working, you know, for Charles Arnell at Mount Hood Snowboard Camp. And we're sharing a pipe with Wendell's and that's who, you know, and Harper's right there. So it was cool. It was like, it was, you know, a real fast track of like, oh my gosh, these guys are the stars. And they looked after, you know, let me in the pipe like that. And then here we are, you know, building pipes together 4 months later. So it was really cool.
That is really cool. What a story. That's super cool. I really liked the entrance there to the pipe too, where he's like, come on, man, you're good. Get in here.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
It wasn't, I wasn't in it early enough, you know, with the guys that have the stories in the mid 80s of like, you know, that really were on the forefront of, you know, getting it allowed at ski areas and really, you know, kind of beating that door down. I kind of got to be lucky, man. I came in when, you know, Trans World Magazine's 500 pages thick. Everybody's getting paid. There's tons of resources that, you know, the ski areas are seeing dollar signs.
Yeah.
And I always say all the time, it wasn't talent. It was timing.
Yeah. Fair. I mean, fair enough. I still believe you have to be good at it so that you can actually compete. I mean, you were there. So, but you know, a lot of the community, associates you with, you know, Terrain Park and half pipe construction in the snowcat, in the machines, But there was this super cool component of you that was the professional snowboarder. So you really knew what you wanted to ride. You knew what your transition wanted to feel like. You knew what tricks you wanted to do. And I think we're starting to see more of that in the operator components. I mean, you've got other individuals out there like Charles Beckinsale, pro snowboarder, snowcat operator, just as an example. But I think that has to be a part of this story somewhere. But I want to know, like, where the pro snowboarding kind of ended and you transitioned into the snowcat. Was it more or less just a, hey, I'm out, I'm hanging it up, I'm retiring from this and I'm moving on? Or was it, hey, I'm still going to ride in this stuff and compete a little bit, but I'm also going to kind of, you know, put my interests towards the machine and figure out how I can build the pipe as well? What did that transition look like?
You know, it was a two-part process. The way the consulting started were, and I wish I could remember the year, it was either 94 or 95. Bjorn and Eric Linus and JJ Thomas were guys that worked with us at the snowboard camp in the summer, and I got to know their parents, and being older, I could rent the car. So they'd travel with me to all these events. So we went to Kirkwood, funny enough, you know, with Benell and Corley out there killing it at Kirkwood. We get there and there is a 45 degree bank with about a 1 foot, you know, vertical curb. There's no pipe dragging, you know, and the guy's gay. I mean, it was clean, you know, they had done it, and everybody's like, well, we can't compete in this. You know, there's nothing we can do. And Craig Elledge was the guy. He ran the AST, the American Snowboard Tour, back then. And, you know, we were going to cancel it. You know, it's an epic California weather. It's like 50 degrees. And I just went to him and I said, hey, because those kids, like I said, that I mentioned, they were all on our dig crew up at Mount Hood, and we were still hand digging all the pipes. And I went to him and I said, hey, man, we can do the event. I'll dig it with these guys. And I got him to pay us for it. And that's kind of where it started, is, doing that. And then by, like, I want to say that was 95. And by 96, then, you know, I was on Solomon at the time, Solomon and Bonfire. That was kind of, you know, that was my best year. That was the year that I won that tour, the overall, you know, by getting a lot of second places and having Todd Richards not come to one of the events allowed me to win. If he would have showed up, he would have won. So he missed one of the events, and it enabled me to do that. But that's where it started. And really, for those years, you know, guys like Flutto and Mike Bunnell, I mean, I spent hundreds of hours over those, you know, those couple of years riding shotgun with them and different guys all around. And really, what I was there to do was just give the opinion of not what the machine could do, because I had no idea.
Yeah.
It was, you know, what vert do we like? You know, what degree and angle? And really, totally, it was the blend of the flat bottom is kind of where I credit, you know, that's how I got started. You know, the guys wanted it when the Pipe Dragons did come out, you know, as Bunnell referenced, you know, they fell apart.
Yeah.
They just were all over the place. And one of the biggest things is that you really needed a flat floor to have that machine work correctly. So kind of what the art we had back then was, you know, how you dish the floor for that finals day. Mm. And that really kind of became the signature thing of what we would do and led to consulting. Cause for a while there, I mean, for 2 years there, I'd show up at every event, you know, a week early. And, you know, I mean, even to the point, I think 1 year when I was talking with Craig, I had a little influence on the schedule because I needed to have time to be able to go help them with the pipe.
Yep.
Prior, you know, they were going to go back to back weekends, and we're like, well, look, there'll be no time.
Yeah.
You know, we need to space this out. So it was really cool. And then to be honest, from a financial standpoint, I can credit 100% Steve Van Doren. I was a pro for Vans, and we all had, you know, at the time, like I said, snowboarding was in a great place. We had really good contracts. Steve had the triple crown of skateboarding, and he's like, hey, we're going to do a triple crown of snowboarding. And he had bought he owned High Cascade at the time. And I was up at Mount Hood working at Mount Hood snowboard camp. And he came by and he said, hey, I want you to do the pipes for this Vans triple crown series I want to do. And I was like, okay. And he goes, how about we just keep you on your same salary that you're on now, and you're a consultant now. And I'm like, perfect.
Yeah.
So I never missed a paycheck. Like,
wow.
It went from being a pro on Vans to now I'm a consultant on Vans.
Wow.
For Vans.
Dude.
So again, very fortunate timing, you know, and an amazing person. I don't know if anybody doesn't know who Steve Van Doren is, that is the rock star of all action sports. He loves these sports more than anyone that I've ever met. Just unbelievably genuine guy. And obviously Vans being the amazing company that it is.
Yeah. Wow. Well, okay, let's back up real quick. And I just want to unpack one little piece of that. And that was the podium and being kind of on the second place tier. And was that difficult? I mean, I know everybody wants to win, right? Maybe you got one guy in the way. You got a funny story about Mr. Richards.
Yeah. Todd is just, you know, I could go higher than he could in the pipe, ooh, but that was the end.
Yeah.
He had every trick and with style and just, you know, still to this day, you go riding with him. He's amazing.
Yeah.
And so Todd had my number. The one I did win once.
Cool.
But it was only for about 2 minutes.
Wait, how does that work?
And it was in Hunter Mountain.
Okay.
And it was, you know, it was a real battle to get this pipe built. Again, another one where they were going to cancel the event. You know, I wish, you know, like Benel said, we didn't have cell phones and everything back then to take photos, but we basically built a pipe with the pipe dragon, you know, how it drags the snow up. We put hay bales and plywood and everything we could do into this pipe. You got two tickets. You got two practice runs,
okay,
for this event. So we do it. It was my first event on Solomon. I had just gotten on the Solomon international team. So we do the event and I felt like I had the winning run, you know, I'm like, oh yeah. And so gets announced, they put the, you know, we do the medals, we do the podium. Brushy got second, Jeff. And so it's me, Brush, and I forget who was in third. It might have been Ron Chiodi or something. But anyway, we go, we're sitting there, and then while we're sitting there, the announcer goes, hold on, we've made a mistake. There's been a mistake in the judging.
What?
And I look out, dude, no one will look at me. And I mean, at this point, people are dropping up, you know, like, fuck that, fuck them, Frank. Yeah. Tell them to fuck off, yeah. Tell them to fuck off. And man, at this time, this tour was sponsored by Bud Light.
Yeah.
We were getting paid to snowboard. I was getting paid. We pulled off the pipe. We're with all of our friends.
Yeah.
I took off the first place medal,
yeah,
gave it to Brush,
oh,
reshot the interviews, redid the whole thing.
No.
And Brush is pulling me up, you know, like, come on, it's trying to, you know, we're standing, you know, we're getting photos. Dude, best thing I ever did, because from that point on, I can't even name, you know, the Mateus brothers, Dave and Steve Mateus, all these people that were there, mm, who now 25 years, 30 years later, you know, I still work with. Mm. And it was one of those things that you don't see it as a, you know, what can be a character defining moment, mm, but it was genuine in that, man, we were all going to, it was the 10% rule was in full effect. We were going to go all drink after that event. We were getting paid to snowboard and we were in Hunter Mountain, New York.
Yeah.
So it's definitely one of those things that thank goodness I didn't let my emotions get the best of me and act like an ass. So.
Yeah, dude, that's big because, you know, in a world of tangible achievements, people like to have the gold hanging around their neck to say, look what I did. And it, you know, sometimes it's all about the me, my, and I show. That's big. I agree 100%. That was probably a character defining moment for you.
Yeah. And like I said, it's the, you know, again, the networking in this business is everything. You know, there's so many people that you work with at a certain time. And, you know, it's a small industry. You don't want to burn bridges in any industry, but the ski industry especially. Everybody knows everybody. And that's what makes it cool. That's what makes it fun is, you know, everybody, you know, we've seen these sports go from hand-dug half pipes to now, you know, 22-foot pipes. So it's really cool. Now the Richards would just, he could get the best of me because he was obviously way, way better. But we had 1 year at Snowmass, and it was, I think it was the year before they were trying to do the Olympic qualifier. So it would have been 96. And they did a head-to-head for whatever reason. And it ended up being me and Todd in the finals. So we were guaranteed first and second place. So, you know, first place is 10 grand, second is 8 grand or 7 grand or something. You know, it was good, really good money for us. And I remember me and Richards in the start gate joking around about the 10% rule, like, man, we got $1,800 to put on this bar tab. So the fact that that's what we were talking about before we were competing is still, I look back on it and it's epic.
Yeah.
It's just epic. So I think from a competition standpoint, you know, I kind of knew that, you know, there was no way I was going to be able to keep making a living doing it. And in the pipe, I distinctly remember being at the bottom of the pipe. And I think Sean was probably 14 I think Andy Fent, there was a couple guys, I mean, obviously just tons, but I had no chance to win. And not to say that I could have won, you know, before, but it was like, there's no way. These guys are doing back-to-back Hawken flips. It's just, the sport has changed. And I remember, you know, I'd gotten in late. My first day ever on a snowboard, I was, you know, 20 years old. So at this point I'm like 28 and I'm like, man, I got, you know, I'm going to start transitioning to this other side. And Mountain Snowboard Camp, you know, I know we talked about Charles Arnell. That, again, I say timing, not talent. When I moved to Breckenridge in 91, Charles and a bunch of the guys lived up on Peak 7 in Breck. And Charles was like, yeah, I'm going to do a snowboard camp. And I was just on him every time I saw him. Like, dude, I'll do anything. I'll do it. Just, I need a job. I got to get to Hood. And I'll be damned if I didn't do everything. You know, we'd start out in the morning and we'd carry the gates, you know. Back then, cool. You know, it was moguls, yeah. Gates, the whole deal.
Whole shebang.
So we'd set the gates, come back to the parking lot, get the 5-gallon water, you know, thing to take back up. And then we'd go start digging on the half pipe once it got soft enough. So, yeah.
So that was pretty much it. Like, that was the beginnings of you was and your consultant and construction career for the pipe was up there at Mount Hood Snowboard Camp in Charles Arnell.
Yes, 92. And it was two guys that I have huge respect for that I learned a ton from were Jimmy Scott and Terry Kidwell. Mm. They were digging for Wendell's. We shared, 92 was a really rough year. I didn't know any better. It was my first year on the glacier, but it was one of the lowest snow years. So Wendell's and Mount Hood Snowboard, we actually had to share a pipe at one point in that summer. So, you know, unbeknownst to me, you know, just they're the heroes. Like, there was, you know, got Jimmy Scott, Brian Harper, you got all these different people. So, you know, pretty quickly, you know, you start meshing and it's, again, just like Breckenridge, such a great crew. And I did 10 summers up there. I did 10 straight summers. It was, Hood's a magical place.
Yeah, it is.
I love Hood. And it's kind of funny now because it's come full circle. I'm back up at Hood, you know, for 4 or 5 weeks, you know, in the summer now. I did it last summer and I definitely plan on going back up there this summer.
Cool. So you're doing the pipe up there again? This summer?
Yeah.
Sweet, man. That's awesome. That's definitely a full circle. So I wanted, Tim Reed was somebody, we didn't really touch on him. I wanted you to hit him and just kind of tap him with how he was an influence or an impact. Where did he fall into play with your career?
You know, I think I can back up even further. So, you know, I kind of talked about the Vans Triple Crown. At the same time, I competed in the first 3X Games, and the first year, you know, was at Snow Summit. So it was Gunny and Mike Bunnell and that whole Snow Summit crew, you know, built the courses and did everything. And so, you know, we all became friends. We were riding, and it kind of, as soon as, you know, I guess that would have been 97. So, you know, that 98, 99, kind of they had the X Games and were slopestyle guys that were, you know, really good, best in the world at building slopestyles. And I was just doing half pipes. And so when we kind of got together and it was kind of, we both, you know, they were bringing X Games to the table as a contract and I was bringing Vans, and it was just perfect because then it was, you know, we were working both these events together. So it was awesome. And that's kind of how we got going. And, you know, like a Tim Reed, a great example, Tim was, you know, working on the fence crew and the banners and stuff at Crested Butte. And now Tim runs the whole X Games global brand. So, again, it just goes to show, you know, over time, the network and the ski business, it evolves more than it really truly changes. I feel like, if that makes sense. You know, people get into it, they have the passion, they have the love, they're probably going to continue up the food chain, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Tim Reed, I would love to meet Tim Reed one day. That would be incredible. So, but I also want to know too, like, your take on really the evolution of the operator, the training aspect of it, sharing the knowledge. That's a constant subject on the show, but also maybe kind of like who you were around that were influential. I know we've talked about a few names, but what does that evolution look like? And then also the retention piece of hanging on to an operator and keeping them around.
Honestly, it's all the, you know, the Jeff Floods, Mike Bunnell, you know, Corley Howard, all the different guys that we've all worked together. The joke I always say, I mean, I'm going to train people, but I'm just making new friends. It's not like you don't hang out with people anymore. You know, it's like, of course, you know, of course you want to go do it. And I think that's the other side of when you talk about the evolution, you got to remember, people are going to learn what not to do from you, just like they're going to learn what to do. And that's an ego position you have to learn to get over to go, yeah, you know, maybe that's not the, I didn't handle that the best or something, but people are still, you know, they're going to take away from that. And I think that's something, you know, we all kind of get in your bubble. You're like, oh man, I only want the good, you know, this and that. Cause I mean, I've worked with so many different guys, and I don't say, oh, I taught this guy how to cut a pipe. That's not at all how it happened. Those guys, you know, we were there, they went and mastered the craft on their own. They, you know, I might've had a little influence here or there where they were getting to, you know, getting into it. But yeah, that's, you know, to me, it's amazing in that it's, there's just, we keep cycling through. You know, you've got all these different guys. You look now, you know, around the world, you got Jeremy Carpenter over in Lux. You got, you know, Andrew Erath doing X Games. You've got, you know, Nick Simon at Breckenridge. And it's been rad because I've known all these guys for so many years. And it's just fun to know when I'm, you know, at Mammoth or wherever, you know, up in Calgary cutting a pipe, everybody's doing the same thing somewhere else in the world. And we're all kind of from the same club. So it's cool.
Yeah, that's definitely got to be cool nowadays too, with just that instantaneous piece of communication. You can kind of all be like, yo, hey, what you got going on? But to put together a skill set in a very short period of time that is successful, the same thing applies. No matter you're grooming trails or you're building half pipe or you're building park, it's not like you're going to be mastering it right away, I guess is my point. It's going to take time, I guess, depending on where you're building and what you're building. That from my
yeah, it, you know, and it just depends on what you're building. You know, if you're you know, somewhere where you can, you know, like a Mount Bachelor or Mount Hood, if you were going to, you know, not in dirt work or anything like that, but you're just going to go out and dig a hole, you know, it's not going to be as important, you know, to get it just right. But you know, like at Bachelor in the dirt work, you know, you got to do the process, you got to layer it in, you got to get it all there. And you know, perfect examples in the summer at Hood, you know, we're just digging them out. And, you know, that's being managed throughout the winter. You know, you got Danny up there when there's an ice storm, you know, he's going through and chopping all that ice up and knocking it out so we don't get those ice veins in it. But, yeah, it takes some time. I think it's just, you kind of, people feel like they get stuck in the pipe is what I've found. And there's people that can kind of handle that. And then there's people that just get up, they just don't want to, you know, like Debbie at Copper, like amazing cat operator, you know, and she's a really, really good pipe cutter. And she just did not want to be in there anymore. You know, she wanted to be able to get out on the hill and winch and, you know, not just be married to this half pipe that she has to cut during every single thing. And it, you know, it literally drove her back to just operating, you know, on Alpine.
Yeah. I mean, from the learning point of view, from the mastering the skill point of view, huge shout out to Debbie, by the way. She literally was able to say, dude, just shut up and see it from my perspective for a second, because it's beneficial to me if I leave this ditch. And that was huge. But then you have other programs that opportunity isn't even available in-house anymore. It's left. It's gone. Like Breck doesn't even have a pipe anymore. Like to me, it's mind-blowing. Oh,
yeah. And yeah. You never stop learning. Ever. None of us are ever going to master this. It's always going to be different. I mean, the snow, the median itself is the main thing. I mean, that's, to be completely honest, there are, you know, when it comes to guys, there are so many good, unbelievably good half pipe cutters in the world. You know what I mean? A lot of the guys I just named, you know, to me, it's, I have the time in the weather and the snow is more of my expertise, honestly, than operating the machine. You know what I mean? As far as just having made so many of the wrong calls of like when to cut, when to do the floor, you know, all those different kind of things. And so you're constantly learning, you know what I mean? And that's the beauty of this. That's the beauty of driving them. I mean, I feel like, you know, I mean, I learn from just about everybody I get in the cat with.
Yeah. Relationships, man, they're key. And we've talked about that a lot too on the show, but relationships relating to business decisions and operational decisions, man, they're so key.
Oh, absolutely. Especially early on, when we weren't really in the room, you know, from the standpoint of somebody's putting on an event and, you know, to their credit, they're worrying about TV and sponsorship and fans and safety and catering and everything else. And, you know, that's where like guys like a Tim Reed come through so hard, is because you can go to him, explain him and, you know, say, man, if I could get in there and cut at 3 o'clock instead of waiting till six, I can do this, this, and this, you know, and you kind of make your case. And, you know, as the industry developed and as our relationships developed and people started really, you know, taking stock in what we had to say and being able to put it articulately and prove, you know, kind of prove what we're doing. It's like, I'm not doing this because I want to be done at, you know, 7 o'clock and head to town. I'm doing this because if I cut in the sun, you know, I can get the finish and, you know, whatever the case may be. And I think that's something for people to definitely take away is you have to be able to read the room. In any industry, you got to be able to know what's your audience, what are they looking for, and when is the time to strike? You know what I mean? It's, you might have a, you know, your grooming man, they could be, you know, avalanche control issues or whatever is going on. And that's not the time to bring up the fact that you want to close the pipe earlier. You want to, you know, change something. So I think that, you know, the relationship part of it is really key. I mean, it's probably the number one thing to me in everything in life, you know, whether it's your, you know, your marriage, your job or anything, is that communication piece and, you know, how well you can execute on that.
So before we get too far along, I want to jump into something you already know about, but it's the push road question of the day. Don't want to miss out on that with you.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely want to jump into that. So if you are listening right now and you want to send us a push road question, you can. Right now, you can send us those questions via direct message on Facebook. You can send them in via Instagram, Twitter, however you want to send them. You can even shoot us an email. You can head over to thebladedive.com and send us a question via an email from the website. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump in today's push road question of the day.
Question of the day.
That's right, the push road question of the day. And so let's get right into it right now, Frank. I'll go ahead and play it for you.
The blade dive question of the day. This is for Frank Wells. Frank, your career has taken you all over this planet. If you had to pick one and only one resort to ride the rest of your time on this rock, where would it be and why? Second question, are we ever going to see bigger half pipes or has the max bar been set? Peace, brother.
Cool. That,
Mr. Bunnell himself.
Yeah, man, that is, I mean, it would probably be, my gut is I got to go with Silverton. We were, you know, when we did the pipe for Sean there, we got to spend so much time there. I love the way, there's so many great hills. It's hard to pick one, but, you know, the combination of a single lift, you know, 120, 180 people a day. Baldface would be right there too, though. You know, I got to stick with Silverton though.
Solid choice.
Yeah.
Solid choice. Yeah. Can't go wrong with either. But yeah, I've never been. So Baldface is legendary in itself, and I've never experienced Silverton. So hopefully one day for sure. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, I was very fortunate to be able to go there before that, you know, with like Otterstrom and Aaron Dodds and some guys. We did some stories down there, and it was it's just such a cool spot. I love the San Juans. Now, pipes getting bigger. That's the question we always get asked, usually by people that are doing dirt work or spending money on a cutter. wanting to know that, is this it? Is this it? I mean, it's hard to say. It feels like it could go a little bit bigger. It would definitely need to go steeper. I think the bar has been set. There's no doubt that the best pipe in the world is LOX. You know, obviously Jeremy's doing an amazing job cutting a perfect pipe, but also that 19 degree pitch, the extra length. I think, you know, if we are going to go anywhere, I think we'd migrate a little bigger, probably more like kind of the plus style where you're getting a little more cutting under the tracks, making the dish a little easier. And then, you know, that I don't see us going over, you know, 24, 25, but I could see, you know, potentially, it could go that way. It's so hard. You know, we've gone, there's more bobsled tracks open right now than there are 22 foot half pipes in the world. Like, you know, and that's just a fact. So, you know, again, Locks is kind of pushing it. And you talk to any of the riders and you can just watch the riding. You just, the amplitude and smoothness is just insane. Again, a lot of that's a credit to Jeremy cutting an absolutely perfect pipe, but you know, that 19 degrees is a big component as well.
Yeah. I see your point. I see your perspective for sure. And it's always kind of it's definitely a topic of conversation. I feel like it could definitely go bigger. I feel like it could go bigger. But I like the smaller half pipes more so than I do the bigger ones. That's just cause I'm old.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's just cause I'm an old dude now, but, I like your take on that and the future and what it looks like to be able to have a product that is 22 feet tall at a resort. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, really cool. Thanks, Frank.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is too, is that, I mean, if you got to look back and just, you know, history repeats itself. You know, aerials, moguls, they're incredible in skiing, you know, freestyle skiing. I mean, those are unbelievable athletes doing unbelievable things. It became unrelatable, and we're kind of, you know, we're already at that crossroads, you know, so many years of conversation like, oh, we can't let slopestyle and half pipe turn into that. And you can't stop progression. The kids are going to keep progressing, you know, the quads and the slopestyle. And I mean, triples will come to the pipe. You know, there's been a few done, but it'll kind of head that direction. And, you know, you can't stop progression. I'd rather see more stylish, you know, not that guys aren't doing stuff stylish when they're going huge in the pipe, but it is, you know, we are getting in that, you know, I mean, honestly, we're probably already there and it's just not relatable, you know? And as far as, you know, moving merchandise and really selling the lifestyle that snowboarding has done such an incredible job with starts to stray when you just, you know, you got guys just, you know, going absolutely crazy. The guy on the weekend doesn't relate to that. You know, he watches an edit on Instagram and sees people hit, you know, Main Park at Mammoth. And he's like, oh, hell yeah, I want to go do that. I can do that.
Yeah.
You know, and it gets that way. I mean, there was, you know, we kind of go through the same thing when you see, you know, the big movies of Alaska and whatnot, you know, obviously that's the pinnacle. That's what you want to do. But, you know, how much product is that moving when you've got kids in the Midwest that are hiking rails and hitting up their local hill? You know, they want to see the latest edits in the street and what's being built in the parks. And so, I mean, I know I kind of went on a tangent there with it, but bigger pipes is going to lead to more spins, you know, 1980s or whatever. I don't even know what the math gets to.
Yeah. But it's a good point though, because I think you're spot on, you know, progression is inevitable. If you go bigger, you're going to have bigger and better tricks, but at the same time too, you're trying to also from a qualitative and quantitative standpoint justify it as a business decision too for any resort that's trying to build one. And you know, your average Joe is going to be more interested in participating in the lifestyle.
Yeah. I think I gotta give Mammoth credit and Boreal and stuff of, you know, having the 12-foot pipes, the 13s, whatever, you know, having the 18-foot pipes, doing the smaller pipes. It's, you know, for a while there, you know, when the Pipe Dragon first came out, again, you know, just kind of like the ebb and flow with skate parks, you know, everybody had a half pipe.
Yep.
Like I remember, you know, when we had pipes, you know, there was a pipe at all four ski areas in Summit County. You know, a pipe at A Basin in the spring down by the beach. Copper had a pipe. Keystone, as soon as they allowed snowboarding, had a pipe. You know, Breckenridge obviously had a pipe. And you look at it now, and you know, there's one pipe in Summit County and it's a Copper Mountain and it's 22 feet.
Yep.
You know, and it's kind of sad in a way, because it's, you know, the small pipe, like at Mammoth, if you sit on Jill's, you know, right there, it's amazing how many people go through that little pipe. And so I think there's a lot of guys out there that, you know, guys and gals that are running programs that realize that we need transition to stick around, and it doesn't have to be the 22 foot, you know, mega ramp, if you will. There's a lot of other options out there that are really user friendly and get people engaged, you know, keep the sport alive. I mean, at this point, you know, to be a really good half pipe rider, you basically, you know, it's the same as the aerial and moguls. You got to have coaches and travel to get to it because they're not at your resort. So I'd really, you know, hopefully we move back in that direction and I think we are. I think parks, you know, with Peace Park and Holy Boly and stuff, it's bringing transition riding, you know, back into the forefront a little bit, and everybody can do it. You know, you let your amplitude decide how big you're going, not the feature, you know, like a jump or something, you know, where you got your, your mandatory minimums, you know, transition features. I think that's why it's taken off. As much as I hear Brandon doesn't like them.
Oh man, it's a little stab at Dodge there. I will say though, however, his perspective was from the maintenance point of view, and I can definitely empathize there too. I'm not going to back up 1,000 times for transition features, but nonetheless, they are amazing to ride, and I definitely appreciate them. But if you're willing to create things like that, it's definitely an art for sure. I'm going to use the word art. I like using the word art. But maybe shifting over to equipment that you like to run, maybe it's a relic from the past or the current Zog. Did you have a favorite either way?
I think back, you know, when the Dragon was, you know, with obviously the way it works, they work opposite. The Zog is, you know, cutting into new material constantly, bringing it to the floor through the blower, and then you're getting rid of it. You know, whether that's blowing it up out of the pipe or blowing in the floor and pushing it out with the FreeCat. Man, the Pipe Dragon, you know, it didn't last as long, but it did the opposite. It brought snow up the wall and kind of layered it in there. So it was a big deal for us. Pipes, not to say that they weren't always icy. They've always been pretty icy, but man, in Colorado, you could get some pretty good chalky days on a recut pipe, and you still do, but it's just different. So I think it's probably more the nostalgia of remembering. I mean, they were little pipes. They were only 11 feet tall or something, 10 feet tall, but you can't beat the Zog as far as it's dependable. You know, it's a piece of equipment. So of course it has its own, you know, issues like everything else, but yeah, there's just so much you can do with it. And then it's so durable, you know, now that I say that, knock on wood, the one I'm going to get in tomorrow, but you can take them into the park. And I think I love seeing that. I love seeing the transition features, you know, being built, jumps, and it's kind of, you know, that blend of pipe and slope style riding. I really like seeing that.
Yeah. Okay. So just, you mentioned the surface material and just that chalkiness. Setting up something like that is all about a process, and you got to have a good one. And we've mentioned paying attention to the weather and the different consistencies, and maybe making decisions that you shouldn't have, or decisions that need to be made so that the product can be the best for the athlete or the rider. But what is the perfect surface for a pipe? I mean, you got a cold wall, you got a warm wall, you've got different environments these things are built in, different continents, different countries, different wet bulbs, all different kinds of variables. But what is the surface that if somebody were to go, yeah, that feels great, how would you describe that?
The most important thing when you're building a pipe is that all the snow is consistent and the same. You know, and it's just like anything else. You got to play with the cards you're dealt. If it's a bunch of wet snowmaking and you roll it around, you dry it out as much as you can, that's what you get. You're not going to be able to change that. I mean, like we just got done last week building the pipe in Mammoth, and it's kind of the dream scenario happened in that we were really struggling with snowmaking. It was warm. It snowed 110 inches. And they allowed us to farm just a huge area. So, I mean, that Mammoth pipe is probably made up of at least 60% natural snow. And it's a really good consistency. It's got that chalk in the shaded wall. You know, the thermal wall, the heat wall, it's, you know, that's going to turn to slush basically no matter, you know, what you can do unless you're getting cloudy days. But it was fun to be able to push that. It's just such an easier ride pushing natural snow as opposed to just bricking out, you know, the base of snowmaking whales constantly.
Yeah, great points. I will say though too, one of the things that beyond building half pipes out of natural snow, that's definitely a challenge in itself. One of the things that you created alongside the help of other people was Snowpark in New Zealand. And dude, that thing was just a spectacle because I was seeing content come out of there, and this is back when like magazines were super thick and you had to wait like a year before or months before you could see video. But seeing things like the White Album come out of there, Torstein and the, you know, the jump with the car and all that stuff. But like JP Solberg, man, like the stuff he was doing on the jumps down there for that, and just all the riders that came out of there and came down to that area and produced photos and videos. Like it was dope. Maybe let us in on that that whole adventure as much as you possibly can. Yeah. Let us in on that story for sure.
So I had been, like we mentioned before, I'd been at Mount Hood Snowboard Camp for 10 summers. I didn't go back. I had had a, I'd hurt my leg. I'd blown my patella tendon. So I was taking a summer off. And a good buddy, a Canadian, really good Canadian snowboarder and photographer, Jeff Patterson, was down in New Zealand. And he gave me a call and he's like, hey, you know, we were talking about the next year because I was obviously hurt that summer. And he goes, hey, I want to get you down here to New Zealand. I want you to meet Sam Lee and this family. You know, we've got this T-bar going. You know, at that point, they had done a few things with Travis Rice. Like, I think, you know, he had the, if you remember the DC, you know, jumping off the crane into the quarter pipe, because they had a Zog down there and they had had a couple different, I think they had some freestyle ski, like mogul guys that had helped them for a little bit with it. But anyway, we talked and we kind of agreed, hey, you know, let's, you know, I had, you know, at this point I was, you know, well on my way consulting and, you know, it was going to be expensive for me to come down there for them. So we kind of made the agreement that like, hey, let's just, I'll come down for 3 weeks and you just cover my trip. You know what I mean? Cover my plane flight, my food and everything. Let's check it out. Let's see what we can do. So I went down there and I mean, right away, you know, they had the half pipe, they had a quarter pipe. Like I said, Jeff is amazing photographer, amazing CAD operator. And, you know, it was just like, oh my gosh, you know, we can put pipes here. There's jump lines. Like, you know, the three of us just basically drew the thing out on bar napkins, you know, that 2 weeks. Come back, you know, fast forward, like 2 weeks, I come back to the States and I had a job that I was trying to do with Flutto. We had this show called MTV Three-Way Threat and it was going to be snowboarding. It had pro snowboarders, pro skateboarders, and pro surfers. And they built a spine ramp on the strip in Vegas. They rented a beach house on the point at Malibu and we were going to do the snowboarding course that we were going to build, like a modified slope style and pipe at Mount Hood. It had rained. It was really warm. Flutto's like, we just can't do it. So I just got back from New Zealand and I said, hey, we can do this at Snow Park. And man, we turned around. We got 45 pieces of equipment and like 17 people through into the country with permits to shoot with like a 12-day turnaround. It wasn't much. It wasn't 2 weeks. And so it was a real good learning curve for me in the permitting process and how you know, dealing with the consulate and how we got everybody in and making sure that we were set to film. So I went back down, you know, there I am. I'm back, you know, 2.5 weeks later, I'm back in New Zealand with everybody. Like, and, you know, we had everybody there. It was amazing. You know, we came in, we kind of built a jump in the middle of the pipe. Jeff had already built some jumps at the bottom. There was a wall ride. We shot the show and that kind of finalized that, like, okay, you know, we've got to do this. So, you know, through the next couple of years, it evolved into, you know, we started, you know, putting in more of the snowmaking. We got the lift put in, you know, had the lodge built with the hostel in it, got the condos. And the thing that I don't know if a lot of people realize is that, you know, we were off the grid. We were pulling our water out of the ground and cleaning it with we had a little light bacteria plant thing. You know, we're making all our own power. And so you've got, you know, I'm 30 and my business partner, Sam, is 26. And so, you know, we're kind of running the show on this thing and it is a massive learning curve with everything I just mentioned.
God,
water filtration.
And, yeah. I was just going to say, get into like, damn. I mean, you're 30 and 26 and you're basically in a capital adventure, massive piece of property, lots of components to make. What were some of the takeaways from that you definitely are applying to life today? That's huge.
Yeah, it was, you know, again, I know I've heard you say this on the other podcast, the team, you know, Jeremy Carpenter was down there. We had, you know, Elliot Cohn and Brad Hoyter, all kind of people came down and were a part of it. So there were tons of people that helped make Snow Park what it is. From an operational standpoint, I mean, the learning curve on some of the stuff, you know, everything ran off our power generation. And so we had this old fuel tank and we just couldn't figure out. We were shutting down like every third day and just full shutdown to where we had to sink everything off. So, I mean, you got to remember, people are on the lift, done. We're making snow, done. It all just stopped. And we go change the fuel filters and we get it set up. Me and Sam are doing all this. And it's one of those things that, you know, we're sitting there trying to problem solve, like, what is going on? We're getting this particulate. turns out that the guy that was showing up filling the tank, if the tank was too empty, it was old and had corrosion in it, he was filling it with a commercial feed. So he was blasting the inside of the tank. All the rust or whatever is busting it up. It's going into the filters and it's shutting us down. So, you know, you picture us during the day, it's 11 o'clock, there's 600 people there, you know, the restaurant's going, people are eating, the chair's full, everybody's doing everything. And you just see the lights go, and it's me or Sam running to get overalls, jump on the sled, go to the top, start popping off the fuel filters. And I mean, we figured it out. It was probably only 10 days, but I mean, that's not the stress you need when you're in a cat 16, 18 hours a day. Anyway, we're trying to figure out, you know, just how to, we had 95 employees. And so, you know, managing 95, I mean, we were in way over our head.
Wow. Okay. So from an outsider's perspective, all I saw was like the fun. All I saw was the amazing features in the writing. And when you think about what it takes to run, finance, employ, and execute anything out there, especially off the grid, it's not like you can replenish anything at your local Walmart, you know, 20 miles down the road if you're that far away from one at a resort, you know? Like there's
when you pop, like when you pop the hose, mm-hmm. like is going to happen, mm-hmm. you know, it's a 7-day flight to get, you know, 7-day freight. That's a 7-day flight. It's a 7-day freight. Sorry. Cause yeah, everything had to come from, you know, we had all Caspor. So everything had to come from Germany. And obviously there were a lot of other resorts that stocked certain things, but when it came to like the Zog or anything specialty, you know, we just had a farmer down in Terrace that had a crimping machine. So you took the, you know, 2 a.m, you take the hose off, you put it in a garbage bag, you drive down the hill. The next morning, you know, you go, you get the hose recrimped, you come back, you put it back on. So there was a lot of learning like that. I mean, some of the, when we first started before we had the garage, I mean, it was hysterical. I mean, you'd see a cold front coming and we'd need to do service on the cats. So, you know, it's a farm. We had 2,500 sheep that were at the bottom. So we'd go get hay bales, lay the hay bales out, spray them with the snow making so they would freeze. And then we'd drive the cat up on it to do the service, you know, to do the oil change. We did that for one whole season because we didn't have a shop. And once we had a shop, you know, then we were off to the races. But I wouldn't trade it for the, you know, there's a cat we bought. We called it Bullet Hole. It was just a really good cat that we all used at SPT with X Games. And we really liked it. So we bought it and we shipped it down there. And, you know, we're excited. This is the first Bombardier, you know, we got a Bombi tiller to do the pipe of the floor in the Southern, you know, this was it. This is what we had waited for. Crank it up. We go out, we make it maybe 100 feet up the hill and the tiller seal, but it just goes. And we're just like, how is this even possible? And they had serviced it for us. And so Chris Perkins, just a legend in the industry. I'm on a cell phone with him, you know, at this point. And the snap ring hadn't been put on. So, you know, I'm sitting there with all the parts and a bucket of diesel cleaning them out. And he's, you know, talking me through how to put the tiller motor back together with our, you know, me and Sam. So there's a lot of that stuff I would never trade. It was really cool at the time. You know how it is. Whenever stuff's hard at the time, you're sitting there cussing. And then you look back on it and go, man, that's crazy. We got that. You know, we were able to fix that.
Yeah, you know, no, so. That was totally. Yeah, that's wow. That's some perspective for sure.
I wouldn't trade it.
God, what an adventure. You're doing it with your family too. I mean, you're cruising. Like you came from humble beginnings back east and competitive snowboarding and jumping into the consulting scene, and then now you're tackling this massive adventure on a different continent, different country. So cool that you were doing it with the family though.
Yeah. It was also Taylor. My eldest, she was, I think she was like 4 months old when her and my wife came down. So yeah, it was really cool, man. We lived right there in Wanaka. There's a little mountain called Mount Iron. It's just a really fun hike. It's got a, you know, amazing, everything's an amazing view in New Zealand, to be honest, but just an amazing view. So, you know, to be able to, you know, during the day, hang out with them and then go in the evening, that was some of the better years. In the beginning, I can remember me and Jeremy Carpenter living in, sleeping in basically like cots in the spa room because all the rooms at the, you know, so the snow farm, I guess I should explain that. The snow park was the, you know, the, that everybody knew as part of a big property called the snow farm. And it's the Southern Hemisphere's, one of the largest, car proving grounds. So there's all types of test tracks and different things. And my partner in it, Sam Lee, it's his family's land. And so his dad, John Lee, is beyond a local legend. He founded Cadrona. He's kind of known in New Zealand as the snow farmer because it's all farmers in those valleys. Yeah. So, you know, the reason that we were able to make it work at Snow Park is because we had the big brother up the street that could help us out. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, when it would free, you know, they had a shop, they had all the different things. What it turned into a lot of times is just, you know, when the weather would go south, you can't drive a cat, you know, in the mud for, you know, a mile and a half. So that's why, you know, we've resorted to a lot of those, you know, whether it's freezing hay bales or whatever we had to do. But yeah, it's a really amazing family, absolutely amazing family down there in New Zealand, you know, total pioneers, like, you know, godfather of the ski business down there in the Cadrona Valley for sure.
That's so cool. Yeah. And like family's a big component of it too. I mean, balancing all that out, that's something we've talked about on the show as well, because this job in this industry will spit you out really quick. It's definitely a bit chaotic, or can be at points. Side note real quick, was Joe Mack down there with you?
Yes. Yeah. Joe Mack worked with, Andy Kennerly. We had a whole, there's so many good Kiwi kids down there.
Cool.
That were with us. Yeah. It was an amazing, amazing time down there. Just an amazing country. And, you know, like at the end of the season, we would, we'd get an RV and then tour up to, go to Raglan, go surf in Raglan for a little bit before we catch the plane flight home. So yeah, it's an amazing, amazing country for everything related to surf and surf, golf and snowboarding is very good in New Zealand.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I've heard stories, just the fishing down there is absolutely incredible as well. I don't know if you got into that, but the fishing is pretty incredible from what I've heard too. But yeah, man, thanks for letting us in on just the, I don't think they're secrets. I think they're more or less just your learning curve experiences on what it takes to launch something like that from point A to all the way to point Z, and then all the ups and downs in between there. Because it's not like you were going, hey, I got this idea and let's just flip this light switch on, and then here's the resort and or here's the hill and here's the lift. Yeah. So yeah, man.
Yeah. It was a lot of I think, you know, Bunnell's got an electrical background. I think he would have been better. I hated the power. We had to sync these three. You had to do the little generator. I think we had a 150, a 600, and a 1200. The 1200, you know, like a full, you know, 20-foot container. But you had to sync them up, and then you had to shift it all into the grid on this big board. And I remember me and Sam looking at each other like, who's going to do it? You know, wearing wet boots in the water, you know, just like, who's doing it?
Who's going to touch the plug?
Yeah, we needed Bunnell at that time down there with his electrical background.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think another part of your story is definitely that Snowpark Technologies component where – not only were you, well, let's back up. Not only were you a pro snowboarder and you had an understanding of what it was to ride the transition, but you were also in the machine. And so you took your pro snowboarding skill set and were going, hey, I know what I want to ride. Let's make it fun and safe for everybody. But to do that, you were around some pretty cool people like we've already discussed, but you were involved within an organization that placed you into opportunities to build pipes all around the world. And I guess I would like to know too, how much you're ever willing to share. What was that like? What were some of the takeaways from working with Snowpark Technologies? What was that journey like? What did you learn? I know I'm throwing a lot of questions at you right now, but the overall experience, what was it like working for Snowpark Technologies and that experience?
Yeah, you know, like we said, it started with, you know, kind of Gunny and Mike having the contract for the X Games and me helping them with the pipe and then them doing the slope styles for the bands, you know, Triple Crown. Time-wise, I want to say we probably started doing like 6 month, you know, winter contracts would have been sometime around 2000, 2001, sometime in that time frame. And then I kind of was doing, you know, 6 months with SPT, you know, basically exclusively in North America, and, you know, whatever events, I shouldn't say North America as much as Northern Hemisphere with SPT. And then I was going south, you know, for the Snowpark New Zealand. And then once Snowpark New Zealand, once I stopped going down there in 2007, from 2008 on, then I was full time with SPT, right up until 2016.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was great. It was great. Great times, great friends, you know, lifelong friends, amazing, you know, amazing company. We had a blast, you know, from our golf tournaments, all the amazing events we got to do everywhere. And then, you know, towards the end, you know, just as the industry changes, it has its ebbs and flows, as there was just a little less work, you know, a little more time in the office, not quite as much time on snow. Kind of, you know, the writing was there that it was time to probably move on my own. You know, I wanted to continue the snow side of it. Just really didn't want to spend quite as much time in the office.
Yeah. And maybe that's my question. Is this a fair statement? Like, you had reached your ceiling within that organization. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's, you know, my skill set is on the snow. You know, obviously the planning and stuff is very crucial, and that's a big part of what I still do today. It's just, you know, it was, you know, nothing that happened at SPT other than just having less work, you know, and it was just kind of like, all right, well, we're spending a lot of time in the office, so it's probably time for me to move on.
Yeah. And that's a tough decision too, because at that point in time, no matter who you are, you're making a decision based on your skill set.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what you want to get into. So expanding on that is
growing. It was time. It was time to move on to something different. And it's expanded, you know, kind of that opportunity the rest of the year to work on other projects. You know, I'm really fortunate now to be working with some different companies on some different things outside, you know, some inside the snow business and a couple that are out. And, you know, it's fun to have other, you know, projects out there that I'm working on that kind of aren't associated with the winter sports and snow industry at all, you know?
Yeah. So what were your takeaways from working with Snowpark Technologies in the time that you were there? What were those?
The value of just a great team. You know, there was so many years with that group that we had so many great projects and, you know, all being such good friends, and the amount of snowboarding and, you know, we did together and different trips. I mean, just so much travel together, you know. You know, I don't know, 10 years, 12 years or something of, you know, constantly traveling together. So yeah, now it's a great group of people, and still a lot of respect and admiration for SPT.
Right on, man. Yeah. And the things that you got to do with that organization were pretty incredible. But I wanted to ask too, the travel involved with everywhere. Do you speak another language?
No.
Oh, no. Really?
Uh-uh.
I would have never thought.
Yeah. I'll make the attempt a little bit, but yeah. No.
Yeah, I hear you, man. I'm picking up what you're putting down. I guess the kicker would be, I've always wondered what that interest is in the operator. I heard Carpenter's working on it, right?
Yeah, I think he's working on the Swiss German. Mm-hmm. He'll get it, man.
Yeah,
he loves it over there.
Yeah, I would. I've never been to Lox. I would anywhere over there for that matter. I've never been east, but just to be able to have that skill set and just another language to be able to speak for yourself. Represent others, whatever brand you're with. I mean, man, that would be awesome. I wish that I definitely, I had something like that. It's hard enough. I've tried to learn Spanish a couple different times and it's never really sunk in that
well,
process.
And it's, you know, I'll give you a funny example. We were at doing teens, the first year we were doing the X Games in teens, and we're working with Prenoth. And so we kind of like all the North American stuff. We wanted the North American tiller. We wanted the North American joystick, just all the stuff we're used to. We didn't really want to use the power tiller. You know, we wanted PosiFlex, just all the things that we wanted, all our bells and whistles. So the French mechanics were epic. This guy, Mark, was amazing. Spoke really good English. We could communicate with him well. So out of Granby, you know, in Quebec, Bombardier, who obviously got absorbed by Prenoth, you know, they send over their support guy. We're like, cool. And so he comes over and he comes into the shop and he starts talking, and Mark looks at us and we're like, they're speaking French to us, right?
Yeah.
They couldn't understand each other at all. Like, we're all, me and Bada, all of us are kind of sitting around like, hey, what did he say, Mark? And he goes, I have no idea. I don't know. He's like, it's some French Canadian dialect of, and we're all just like, so you're telling me the guy they sent, we can't understand. I mean, we're all just dying laughing. Of course, all the stuff worked out, the computer program, you know what I mean? Everybody was able to do it, but it was pretty funny. Just kind of, you know, when you mentioned that about language, that's probably one of the funnier stories of we're like, okay, both these guys are speaking French, but it's apparently two different styles of it, you know, and they can't understand each other.
That's pretty funny. So here you go. We've hired a guy that's going to tell you what to say. And then also he's going, whoa, I don't understand. Yeah. So that's trippy.
It was pretty funny.
Yeah, Batman. No, but mad respect for anybody that's got a foreign language.
Yeah, I've been on site visits, you know, I'm trying to think who we were with. I guess it was the TTR group for a world championships in China. And I mean, we did one of these things where we're sitting around and everybody's got the translator headset on, and you kind of get the broken English, but I'd sit there at the presentation and think I had a pretty good gist on it. And then, you know, the gal that was with us was taking notes and she kind of prep us at the end. And I was pretty off as far as what they were saying, you know.
And maybe like connecting the dots here, if you know, you're traveling, you're having to manage communication. We've just talked about pretty much the whole footprint within as much detail as we possibly can discuss in a short period of time with Snowpark, consulting, all of it. You know, communication is key, but also kind of how you carry yourself. I've always seen you as somebody that carries themselves as a pro, like all the time. And I think that story about you pretty much handing over the medal based on the judging results changing sums it up as well, too. You know, you've set that example of how you want to carry yourself. Yeah, you love having a good time, but at the same token, you just. From an outsider looking in, you just seem like a genuinely good leader.
Project, well, that's something to say.
Project, family, kind of an ambassador for the industry and the brands that you've represented and stuff that you've built. You're obviously attention to detail, but maybe the question is, was that sense of productivity, that leadership style, that humility, the ability to approach things from a bigger picture point of view, was that something that you had to learn over time, or do you think you were already there at a young age, being able to walk away and kind of go, or take a step back and go, oh, okay, yeah, I see it. I see the bigger picture. Let's see what's going on here.
I think, you know, I'm from the South, and so it's just genuine to just, you know, basically try to be nice. And I think it started with that and definitely evolved as I learned, you know, the same stories as all of us of, you know, when we were building stuff for us, we didn't care, you know what I mean? It was the ski area was half the time, you know, the man, they were the enemy. Mm-hmm. It was like, nah, they don't understand what we need to do this. We need to do that. And it evolves. And I think, you know, learning to read a room is the key. Learning what is your audience? What are you presenting to? Are you having a conversation with the CEO and the CMO? And discussing what this, you know, why contributing these hundreds of thousands of dollars to the shoot is going to be good for their brand image and in line with their brand. Or are you talking to, you know, somebody down at the shop that just does not give two shits that you were there and you just got to be nice to, and it's obvious they don't like you and you just got to be polite and go about your way. So I think, you know, reading the room at a ski area is a big thing. I mean, I've heard you guys say, just people want to hang out with nice people, like people that are fun to work with, and make it a team effort and let people, you know, challenge them in a way that they're, you know, kind of be a guide, if you will, challenge them to the point that you give them a task that you know they can handle and they're learning, but you're not throwing them in the deep end to where you know they're screwed.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a big part of it is just, you know, people want to hang out with somebody that's just not a dick.
100%, man. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, being approachable. What's crazy is that a lot, it's not crazy, it's totally believable. But I would say that all of these conversations that I'm having, every single one of you are approachable. And I think that's so cool because you're totally letting your guard down to catch up and to talk and to share the knowledge. So is like when you're out there and you're training people, do you enjoy that as well? Because you got to kind of let a little bit of that, you know, guard down to be able to teach somebody, because you're sharing information, you're working with somebody and you're communicating, but
Oh, absolutely.
And you can be a little bit of yourself, but when you're teaching somebody, you're really kind of attempting to help them take the training wheels off. And you're giving them some insight, but you're also not trying to be the, hey, this is, it's my way or the highway, man. Like, you know, here it is. Have fun with that. You know, you're genuinely trying to build people up with the knowledge.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you enjoy that?
I love it. Cool. Absolutely love it. Yeah. I love seeing where they go with it. Like how much better they, you know what I mean? That they can get, because I think that there's, you know, kind of people come and go, but genuinely, if you've put in the time, you know, to get to your 5,000, 6,000, whatever, you don't have to have that, but your, you know, your hours to be good enough to be working in the park and someone that the mountain wants to train, you know, you're invested in it. Like you love skiing or snowboarding or snowmobiling or snow bike, you know, you're into it. And so we're just friends that haven't met yet. You know what I mean? So when it's there, it's like, you know, like I'm working with this guy, Joel Bowman at Mammoth right now. And he's an epic operator. I mean, he's obviously been operating for 10 years and he's just starting to cut the 22, but he's got lots of time zogging, obviously, from Keystone. And then, you know, I mean, I've only known this guy, you know, a week or something, but it's awesome, man. He wants to learn. He's good at it. And it's just cool to see, you know, the management at Mammoth be like, yeah, you know, this is going to be our guy. We want to put our, you know, kind of see what's going to happen next in our pipe program with this guy. And it's awesome. I love seeing it. You know, Sam Kiley was there before and, you know, he's an amazing operator. So yeah, it's cool.
I think it's cool that you're a contributor to that. I think that we just hit it on Mike's episode too with Flutto. Like I thought Flutto was a big piece of being an advocate for the knowledge as well.
Oh yeah.
And spreading it and helping people be stoked on being in the machine.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think,
I mean, we've been training people, you know, how many years we've been training people in terrain parks and cutting pipe and everything. And it's still, there's still tons of work to do. And I think that, you know, some of the, what do you call it, proprietary, you know, information people thought they had or do have, you know, they're kind of, it's a little different. And I know I feel like the way guys do certain things in the park more than the pipe, you know, especially jumps in particular, how they like to load people and all that. I feel like, you know, some guys keep some of that kind of tight to their chest. You know, definitely share knowledge, but just have their own little tricks to it. The half pipe, we're kind of building more of a blueprint, you know.
Ooh, it's a good
like
point.
You're going for this, you know, fist standard, if you will, or, you know, and so it's a little different. But yeah, no, it's fun, man. It's fun seeing people do it. And you know, they're going to migrate in and they're going to migrate out. Like there's going to always, you know, the need for high level operators is growing.
Yeah. 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 No, totally. And I also think that's another question too. You've got, how do you retain somebody, I guess is the question. How do you retain that person year after year and stoke them out and keep them coming back? Opportunity is one way that you could probably stoke somebody out. Money isn't the end all be all. You might have somebody that wants to explore a different opportunity elsewhere within the same department, maybe go groom park. Maybe they don't want to go groom park and they want to just get out of the half pipe. But how do you continue to retain that individual or individuals year after year? What's your thought there?
Well, for half pipe, I think it's just all of it is you have to give them room to grow. You know what I mean? You got to give, you know, it's like you don't give somebody a Ferrari for their first car. You know, you got to give them something to work up to. And I feel like that, you know, financial, obviously, ski towns are expensive. Everybody's showing, you know, there's that. But it's really more of what are, you know, are you giving them the management training? Are they learning stuff where they're a part of it? Are they part of the process? Are you really growing that team? You know, are they evolving as they get to go? That's what's going to keep people around. Now, just the sheer, you know, expense of ski towns is, you know, we lose a lot of people to that. And the other thing is that if you, you know, you get the skill set to get, you know, a pipe within a couple inches over 500 feet, chances are you can probably get in a piece of equipment in the summer and do pretty good. And I've seen a lot of guys go that way where, you know, they just, it's a sheer financial decision. Like if it was up to them, they'd be like, man, I'd keep doing this, but you know, I can go do foundations on houses and make, you know, three times the money. So, I mean, that's a problem that goes across the whole, you know, the whole ski area. Setup, if you will. you know, the expense of the housing and all that kind of stuff that comes with it, especially now.
Oh, man, it's so ridiculously expensive to live in a ski town nowadays. Oh, it is. It's so, so expensive. So, but money doesn't grow on trees, and money can't buy you happiness. I think those would be the two things that I would chalk it up to. And ultimately, what you're doing is you're pursuing a passion, and you're moving forward in a direction that you're wanting to create an opportunity, wanting to grow and learn more about. So yes, know your number, know what your salary needs to be to support your family, yourself, but inevitably go after the opportunity, run the wench, groom something different.
And I think that's what I was saying, back to that growth. You know, maybe that's not the best analogy with the car, but just where people can grow mm-hmm. to where they can, you know, get into that, you know, understanding what is the next, you know, okay, I'm the shift manager. Okay, now I'm the grooming manager. Okay. And I think the other thing too is that it's, you really got to decide what you want out of it. Mm. You know what I mean? Obviously you got to get started and you're working in parks or you're working in Alpine and, you know, you got to get your time, but really, you know, kind of, again, back to that goal oriented, just what do you do? You know, is your goal to kind of learn as much knowledge of that skier as you can and then go back to where you grew up and kind of start a program? Do you want to run that program? Do you want to be a mountain manager? Do you want to be a slopes manager? You know, those are the things that really you don't have to decide right away, but definitely start, you know, kind of going that direction when you want to get in. Do you want to be a contract guy? You want to be a guy that travels around and does contract builds, you know, and works with a company like SPT or something like that. You got to decide what that is. And I think, again, back to communication, you know, getting the experience that you can, and explaining why, you know, why you want to do that. And I think that it's there's a balance there. You know, the skier is definitely going to be willing to train and to spend money, but they got to have some return out of that, you know, not infinite return, obviously. But I think that's a big kind of, I think miss is the wrong word, but just, I've seen a lot of really, really good CAT operators kind of not have a plan, if you will, get frustrated and then leave. And then basically be like, man, I can go, you know, I'm gonna go back to whatever it was I was doing before, or an opportunity comes up, you know?
Yeah. What would maybe the piece of advice be that you would give somebody that is either they're a lifer in the industry, been in the industry for a long time and want to see maybe a different opportunity, or they are entering the snow industry for the first time as a career?
Obviously gain as much of the skill sets as you can. You know, if there's snowmaking going on, you know, pay attention to that. That's a big part. You know, look at every part of the park. You know, how's everything being run? How is it being marketed? You don't have to jump in and want to be, you know, a touch point on every single department, but figure out what you want to learn and what you like. And I say take a little more of the entrepreneurial side of, like, you know, if you're at a little ski area and you're getting going and you hang out at the shop, the local skate shop or the snowboard shop, you know, get a rail jam going, get a big air going, you know, try to start networking in your own, you know, little pond there. And that's, you know, going to lead to bigger and better things. And I think that's the learning curve of what all sides of the business are, because, you know, I do as much, you know, now with contracts and setting things up, like in the planning, you know, as anything. And, you know, a lot of that knowledge was gained through working with SPT. But, you know, you gotta figure out what it is you want to do. Because that's the, you know, one of the greatest things I've ever heard is, you know, be careful if you, you know, take advice from people that are living the way you want to live.
Ooh.
You know, I heard that from somebody that was not in the ski business, just a business guy.
Wow. That's a deep blade dive right there. I'm going to take that. Wow. That was a good one. Who's maybe somebody that you took under your wing that you're excited about? Maybe it's the individual you're helping out right now and training, or maybe it's been somebody in the past that you've kind of invested your time in and you are, you're stoked on that.
You know, honestly, I wouldn't say taking under the wing or anything like that, but just having time and working with, you know, with Jeremy Carpenter over in, obviously he's just such a ridiculously good equipment operator, and just our time, honestly, snowboarding more than, you know, he worked at Mountain Snowboard Camp with me. He worked down in snow park with me. We've been friends since probably like whenever he got to Colorado, I want to say 93 or 94.
Yeah.
So, and I love seeing him just literally, like I said, there is no doubt in my mind that locks pipe pipe is the best half pipe in the world every day. I mean, that thing is just, he's got it so dialed. And, you know, I'm so stoked for him that he's over there doing that. So, no, again, like I said, don't take any credit for anything Jeremy's done other than we've been really good friends and done a lot of snowboarding together.
Yeah. But that's rad, though. The friendships can last forever. And I think the impact that we can have on each other as people are, it's powerful.
Yeah.
It's super powerful. Maybe expanding on that, where do you think the future goes? You can, I mean, respond from like a broad perspective, equipment perspective. Where do you think the future of the snow industry is headed?
I think the industry, the upside to this whole COVID mess is, you know, skiing, snowboarding, and golf have gone absolutely nuts. I mean, the same with, you know, home improvement, just anything with that isolation, not being in a big group, you know. And I think that, it, you know, you got to look at the bright side. There's a lot more people. It's an outdoor sport. From, you know, that's kind of the industry is, you know, from 30,000 feet. I think from the operator standpoint, it's really about, you know, how unbelievably good the equipment's getting, how efficient it's getting, you know, with SnowSat, with, you know, the changes in snowmaking. I feel like it's just getting more and more efficient. You know, I'm very fortunate right now to work quite a bit with Mammoth. And it's unreal how much stuff can be done at that mountain. I mean, the amount of resources, I feel like they probably put as much resources as anybody on the planet into their park and pipe program. But yeah, you know, just seeing different, you know, you got Mikey Black down there. That's, I think he's on his fifth year now. And I mean, he is as strong a fifth year operator as you are ever going to see.
Because, Mikey's crushing.
Oh my gosh. He's getting so much time. I mean, he's very passionate, very good at it, you know, still rides everything. But it really is that, you know, it's just getting, compared to other places, you know, there's years that he starts pushing snow in November and he's still pushing snow in July. So,
yeah,
you know, all the guys down there, you know, there's the skill set down there with Slammer, with everybody, you know, there's just a lot of really good operators and they're just, it's an incubator. There's just getting more and more. And I think that's the one thing, you know, you're seeing kind of the Vail resorts really shy away from the park and pipe program, but then you're seeing like a Powder Corp. You know, you're seeing them just go, you know, basically balls to the walls now with Woodward Park City and Boreal and Copper, you know, and Mount Bachelor. They're putting a lot of money into it. So, you know, you get the ebb and the flow between the companies. And I think it'll be interesting to see if Vail kind of turns the dial back up in a few years, or if it truly something that they're just kind of, you know, kind of letting the other companies run with.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good take. I didn't expect an answer like that. I think that it's going to be an ebb and a flow situation. It's going to be an up and a down. You know, there are patterns. There are cycles that happen. So yeah. I think it's important to consider all of those things.
Yeah, exactly. And, it, you know, I mean, it's honestly like a Mammoth. You know, you get to Mammoth and you just look at the yard and, you know, there's a 13-foot cutter on a winch. There's a 22-foot cutter on a winch. There's an 18-foot cutter if you need it. There's, you know, a fork cat. There's a fuel cat. There's 7 Park Pros. There's a 400 winch. I mean, it's the equivalent of, you know, the X Games build or a, you know, an Olympic build every day. You know, it's there every single day. They have the resources. So again, you know, and it's the same thing as far as the resources being put into, like we were saying, some of the powder resorts and things, and you know, like you know, Canadian Olympic Park up at Windsport, you know, the commitment they have with the cats and cutters and everything up there. So, you know, there's still people doing it. It's, you know, I think it's continuing on. It'll be interesting to see, like you said, I think some of them start looking at the bottom line and decide that whether it's the risk or the client base or whether they're trying to change their image or, you know, I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, to see, like for me, living in Breckenridge for, you know, 22 years, to see them with no half pipe is pretty unbelievable. That's kind of hard to believe that they wouldn't. I mean, I know they scaled down from the 22 to the 18, but it's hard to believe Breckenridge doesn't have a half pipe.
Yep. That one's weird. And, you know, the ups and downs, ebbs and flows of what happens within the industry, we just kind of have to roll with it. And unfortunately it sucks. So, man, huge shout out to Nicholas Simon real quick. That dude is still in the industry and backblading rail takeoffs when I'm sure he'd rather be in the ditch with a Zog. So huge shout out to Nicholas. Frank, I think we did it, man. I think we created something amazing right here. And I just want to say thank you so much for taking time out of your night to come on the show, man. I really appreciate it. So thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Parker.
Wow. Huge thank you to Frank Wells. Thank you so much, sir, for coming on the show and just giving us some insight on what your journey looked like. And the stories, man, there were some good ones. So thank you so much, Frank, for your time. If you haven't already subscribed to the channel and you want to get notifications on when new episodes drop, I would be honored to have you subscribe. Be sure to follow us on social media at The Blade Dive on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you know the deal. Don't be a dick. Fill your machine up with diesel at the end of your shift. We've all done it. Don't be a dick. Fill your machine up with diesel.